I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's one of the classic conflicts in culture, literature, and art, humans versus machines. From John Henry taking on the steam drill to Jeopardy champions taking on the supercomputer Watson, there's been a great cultural fear that when confronted with the machine's speed, logic, and precision, humans will come up short. While some of us might feel we're fighting machines when we lose important documents to hard drive crashes, computer viruses, or the so-called blue screen of death, author Clive Thompson says what we've seen in real life between humans and machines is less about competition than cooperation. He says humans combine their computer's abilities with their own, leading to innovations and improvements in education, political activism, even medicine. And with online social platforms, technology gives us new ways for people to connect and collaborate with each other. Not everyone is convinced these new platforms are always beneficial, though. Critics worry we might become too reliant on machines to do basic tasks for us, like a cashier at a grocery store who can't make change without the help of a cash register. Thompson says these kinds of concerns and challenges are nothing new, and that with little time to adapt to the new normal, people will find much more in these changes to love than to fear. Today in The Exchange, the evolution and revolution in society and technology. And let's hear from you. How has technology or social media changed the way you live or the way you work? What attracts you to these new technologies? And what do you find troubling? Call in The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. You can send questions or comments by email at exchange@nhpr.org, or you can send questions and comments on Facebook or at NHPR Exchange. Our guest today is Clive Thompson, a contributing writer for Wired and New York Times Magazine, and the author of the new book, Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. Clive Thompson, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks. One thing that we often forget in discussions like these is that there's not just one way to think or compute or process. When we talk about humans and computers, it's not necessarily that one thinks better than the other. It's that each seems to handle certain kinds of thinking more effectively than the other.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you think about what are machines good at doing, what are humans good at doing? Well, machines are really good at doing certain repetitive and brute force tasks, counting up huge amounts of numbers, finding, you know, niggling little patterns in data, following routines, you know, perfectly at the same time every day. And these are actually things that we're dreadful at doing. You know, our human minds are terrible at following routines. We're very flighty. Our memories are very fragile. We forget things quickly. But we're really good at making meaning out of things. We're really good at understanding the deep meaning of things. Even if we forget the details, we're good at making meaning out of them. We're good at being social. We're good at understanding other people and how to work with them. And so when you put those two different sets of abilities together, you can get some rather remarkable things done.
You write that today's tech innovations, computerization, online tools, social tools, have several central biases. That is, the main ways in which they shape society, culture, and us. And the first of those is what you call prodigious external memory, that we can record and document almost anything and everything that happens. In a way, this is really just an extension of a process we've always used for external memory. We used to write things down on notes and use paper. This is just maybe a more efficient way to do what we've always done.
Well, yes. In one sense, it's more efficient because when you write an email, you know, you don't print it up and say, okay, I'm saving a paper copy of this. But odds are a copy is saved, right? You know, if you're using Gmail, using any of these huge storage, infinite things, they basically encourage you to keep your email forever. So, you know, if you start using email at age 12 or something now, you could very well get to age 30 having a copy of everything you've ever written in email, as well as the NSA having a copy of everything ever written in email. Well, that's a separate question. But the point is, so for you personally, I mean, it becomes, you know, the fact that in a lot of cases the saving is so trivially easy to do that we do more of it. And so there's been an explosion in the recording of everyday life. And that goes across all media, for photos, things like videos, for things like utterances, you know, utterances on social media. In many cases, those are also archived. And so the interesting question becomes, what is this wholesale recording of our lives going to do to the way that we experience or relive them? That's one of the things I was researching.
And the fact that you're able to do that, it may sound like we're recording a whole lot of mundane things, but sometimes those mundane things can be revealing or even useful. I was reading about former President Ulysses S. Grant, who toward the end of his life had lost the ability to talk because of cancer. So he had to write down every communication that he made to his nurses or to his family. And that became immensely useful for historians. They were able to hear what his day-to-day conversations were like, whereas other leaders of the time who were able to speak, those conversations are lost.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, some of the forms of data we're recovering or we're saving there are really, really interesting because they are conversational, right? Most of the writing we do when we are sitting down and clacking at our keyboards is somewhere strung between formal writing and conversational writing. That's what a lot of it. That's what linguists like Naomi Baron have studied, the basis of this language. That's what they say. And this is really, really fascinating and interesting for historians and even for ourselves because it captures aspects of our lives that we otherwise would have vanished. As an example, I was looking around for some document on my computer, and I discovered, just a few months ago, I discovered a 10-year-old archive of instant messages that I had traded with my wife back when we had first just started going out. So we weren't, you know, I don't think we were even really yet going steady or anything. We certainly hadn't married. And it was absolutely fascinating seeing how we related to each other back then. It was quite delightful. I was actually, in a way, I was pleased because I'd realized how much of this stuff I'd forgotten and how much of the warp and woof of our everyday lives had slipped out of my memory. And so it was a wonderful way to go back and relive and re-experience that and see a part of myself that had slipped away.
For many of us, that's a process that's going on kind of in the background. But you write about a number of people who are known as life loggers, and they're very conscious that they're trying to document everything that they're doing through these automatic tools, through automatic capture of email or phone conversations, but also that some of them have little cameras that they wear that are taking pictures every so many seconds. And what is it that attracts them to being able to document even more of their lives than what you or I might be able to do?
Yeah, I wondered about this because, I mean, for me, it seemed a little over the top, right? I enjoy saving pictures of my kids, but I don't think I want a picture every 30 seconds, which is what these people were doing. So I essentially said, so, you know, what do you get out of this? You know, what do you find? How do you find it improves your life if it does? What they told me were two things. One is that it made them feel more present in the moment because when they weren't thinking about having to record something or having to remember something, it allowed them really just to be a lot more focused and present with the person they were talking to, with looking at the thing they were looking at. And that was kind of interesting. They actually said it got them away from that pulling out the phone and taking a picture of things moment because the pictures have been taken automatically. The second thing was that they said that they liked the idea that that should there be something they really wanted to recover, it was probably going to be there. Almost none of them spent a lot of time going through this stuff. And that's partly because you don't have another life to relive your previous life, right? You know, I mean, like if you collect a really superb archive of your life, it's not like you have the exact map of time to go back and look at it. So they didn't, I don't think they necessarily spent a whole much more time you and I did going back into archives. It's just that when they wanted to, it was there and it was accurate. And those were the two, that is what they said they liked about it.
The question that you hear sometimes around this ability to document so much is, it sounds something like, is my smartphone making me stupid? In effect, as the smartphone is remembering these daily tasks and doing the documentation, is my brain just sitting there unused? And do we know what's then going on while the smartphone is doing this? Is our brain sitting there, or is it doing more?
Well, I mean, our brain is never sitting there. Our brain is always active in doing something. Whether it's doing something productive and useful that we want it to do, that's really the question, right? So the brain doesn't just slacken and sort of turn into porridge, if we stop doing long division. It's a good question. It's sort of like it's almost like what people say the Google question. If I'm Googling for a piece of information to try and remember it, does that mean that I've got out of the habit of remembering, you know, details, and am I getting stupider in that sense? And this is something that I genuinely worried about because I think, like everyone else, I have that feeling of I get a tip of the tongue syndrome. I reach for my phone to Google something, and thought, wow, is this just like the digital senior moment, you know? But the more I talk to memory scientists, the more I was calmed down for two reasons. One is that, you know, we have always, long before technology, been terrible at remembering details and facts. Again, you know, I read a newspaper story, I'm good at storing the meaning, but the basic facts, if you ask me a week later, they're all gone. And that's why for eons, for millennia, we've relied on written down notes to try and refresh things when we need to re-encounter the specific details of something that we're trying to think through. But the problem with the written down notes is that they're hard to access and we don't do it very often. Like Encyclopedia Britannica, you know, in one sense, that's all world knowledge there, right? You know, you buy a copy, you've got it. But when they did a study of their own users, they found people, on average, looked at their encyclopedia once a year. Right, once a year. You've got all knowledge on tap, you look at it once a year, because it's kind of a pain in the butt. So what we do when we're faced with our brains that have forgotten these little details, that we look to two things. Usually we look to friends around us. It's called transactive memory. We talk to people. We say, do you know this? You know, oh yeah, where were those drone strikes? You know, oh yeah, Waziristan. You know, how do you convert Fahrenheit to Celsius? I think it's this. You know,
where the checkbook is, because my wife knows where it is. I could just ask her.
Exactly. You and your wife, you forget things because the other person's remembering them. This transactive memory, very old technique. It's a perfectly valid and terrific way to optimize our flighty brains to work in concert with each other. We are social thinkers and we're social rememberers. So, and studies and study after study show that groups of people are better at remembering and performing and analyzing than they are individually, because our isolated brains are just less strong when we put them together in a team. So really what we're doing with the Google stuff, this is what I learned, is that we're sort of incorporating it into this social remembering. And in many respects, it's actually a great partner to have in that social remembering, because it knows more than, you know, my wife knows or my friend knows or my father knows. And really the challenge for us is learning how to use tools like Google thoughtfully, so we know what their biases are. I mean, it's a for-profit product. There's advertising dictates in there, and we have to learn, and kids have to be trained to disambiguate those biases. But if we get to that point, I don't think it's a problem at all for our memory. I think this is an extension of a historical terrific mode that we've had, this transactive memory, for having two heads be much larger than one.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We've been talking about social remembering, so we're going to talk about social forgetting after we come back from a break. We invite you to join us here on The Exchange with author Clive Thompson. The Exchange phone number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email with your questions or comments, exchange@nhpr.org. More with Clive Thompson after a short break. This is The Exchange.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. New Hampshire weather, we have a freezing rain advisory in effect for most of the state till noon today. It remains in effect in Hillsborough and Rockingham County till 4 this afternoon. A winter weather advisory is in effect for Coos County till 4 this afternoon. Stay with NHPR this holiday season, where we've scheduled a number of special programs telling stories that remind us all what the season is about. And, of course, we'll bring you lots of music to bring you some of that holiday cheer. Have a look at our full holiday schedule at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from UNH Continuing Education, extending warm holiday wishes to one and all and announcing January term and spring registration currently ongoing. Learn.unh.edu. And Waste Management, with a reminder, new energy efficient CFL bulbs contain mercury and need to be recycled properly. Details on bulb recycling at thinkgreenfromhome.com. It's 9:20. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with science and tech writer Clive Thompson about his new book, Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. And we'd like to hear from you as well. Call in at 1-800-892-6477. You can send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment or question on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. We were just talking about a phenomenon called life logging, about people who are documenting as much of their lives as they can, and the fact that we have been remembering things in a social way for a long time. And one of the questions that came up for me, Clive, in thinking about social remembering was that there are some things we probably don't want to remember. In fact, you write about a man who had set up cameras in his house, and the upside for that was that he could document his son's early life without having to scramble to grab a camera or a smartphone when the little child would take its first step or say his first word. But then he also realized that these cameras could catch him in the shower, and so he had to do some reevaluating of his whole setup.
Ended up building in a sort of a panic button that was like, you know, hit this button if something happened that you don't want recorded. And it could go back, you know, a few seconds, a few minutes, or even like, you know, like a couple of hours, right? So if you have a big shouting match argument with your kid or with your spouse, and you're like, I don't need that in the public record. And so you hit the button and it's gone. And I think that was a really smart design move that we are going to see more and more built into our technology tools, because as much as it is delightful to have these records, there are things that we want to preserve, you know, really just in our minds, to let our minds make sense of, even if it's going to forget them and misremember them, because some of that forgetting and misremembering is part of how we make sense of our lives. It's part of where meaning comes from. So actually, what I'm seeing, it's really interesting, is more and more is this sort of almost this artificial forgetting being programmed into various social apps. Like, you look at things like Snapchat. Why has that become so big? So Snapchat is a little app on the phone that lets someone send a picture to someone else or a message to someone else, and it's not stored at all. It's not stored on either end permanently, right? So if I take a picture and send it to you, you look at it and it's erased, and it's also erased off my phone. So it's a completely transient moment. It's more like just a little message, but it doesn't become part of the permanent record. And I think, and that's become a huge deal. People really love it. And I think it's because people enjoy the idea that some things they want to save, other things they do not want.
It kind of brings up an existential question in a way, in that, as you said, part of what we do in life, whether it's consciously or unconsciously, is we take moments and memories and we place them into a narrative about who we think we are. And the question that you raise is that if we were able to remember everything, what does that say about that process? I mean, what does that say about ourselves?
Well, if we were actually able to remember everything, I think we'd go nuts, frankly. And in fact, we know this because there's a condition called hypermnesia, where basically people have a fantastic photographic memory for everything, and they are constantly bombarded by images from the past, and they have trouble concentrating on things. They have trouble reading because every word triggers a memory. And so, you know, if we developed digital tools that did that to us, I think we know exactly what happened. We would go crazy. The truth is, even these very, very large collections, because there's no time to go back over them permanently, what we're really seeing, and this is where I think things are really fun and playful and interesting and creative, is tools coming up that sort of use little moments that get pulled out of the past that help us almost reflect in a philosophical way on the shape of our lives. Like, there's this great little app called Time Stop. Does one simple thing every day: goes back, finds your check-ins, your Facebook photos, maybe a couple of tweets and text messages, and just emails them to you as a little gazette, a little reminder of here's what you did a year ago. And people who use this love it because it every morning they just spend 2 or 3 minutes reflecting on what their life was like a year ago. And this actually has the best of both worlds. It gives you a little taste of what's out there. It doesn't flood you with it, but it reinforces inside your head the meaning-making that your brain does about the shape of your life. And everyone I've talked to has just found that this is a perfect middle ground between the sort of crazy perfect recall and the fact that we like to preserve the human right to make meaning of what happened in our lives.
This is one of the other central biases that you point out about these new technologies and how they're shaping culture. Was finding connections and patterns that might not have been readily apparent before. And one of the really interesting and innovative ways that these are being used is in the field of education. I remember just a few years back, there was an online effort to bring together all of the information that was available to us here in the Western world about North Korea, which is known for trying to limit the amount of information that gets out of the country. All the photos, all of the data, unclassified intelligence, personal accounts, it was all put into a central repository. And as someone who is just very interested in learning more about North Korea, I found so much new information that I hadn't seen before because it was all put together. So just the fact that it was all centralized made me be able to find more connections and patterns that I wouldn't have been able to find before.
Absolutely. I mean, like, this is again, the sort of centaur thing. So what are humans good at? What are machines good at? Well, the machines are really good at finding little connections and patterns that we can't spy. We're good at saying what those mean. So a really great example of this, I hung out with some students at Fordham University, and they were engaged in this project of using this very simple, fun software that lets you try and de-gerrymander districts. So New York State, horrible gerrymandering. I mean, all these districts have been sort of bent out of shape over the years so that the Democrats who are in them can never get voted out, the Republicans can never get voted out. And it's too complicated a thing for the average person to try and figure out how to solve this problem. So they sat down with this free open source software that these geeks put together in a very public-spirited way that lets you play around with the dimensions of a district, and the software does all the pattern crunching in the background to let you know what the results will be. And, I mean, this is sort of exactly what the pros use when they're paid to deform democracy, right? That's what they do. But these are put in the hands of everyday students. And within a few days, they were all able to produce these fantastic, perfectly fair maps, right? They proved that, you know, democracy could be fixed. But they did it because they had the ability to work with machines that could do the sophisticated pattern crunching while they worked on the high-level meaning, the creation of justice.
Let's take a call from one of our listeners now. Will is on the line from Nashua. Hi, Will. You're on the Exchange.
Yes, good day. And a very interesting discussion. And I was amazed by some of the things that have been going on here. So one of the original comments about the Encyclopedia Britannica, I never really thought of it like that, but that's a very interesting point. And also the ability to sort of review your whole life. There's so much data that one just doesn't have the time, so that's a very, very good point. But, you know, people become slaves to technology. I think that we should use that. I mean, it's the famous saying, they say, you don't keep a dog and bark yourself. So you use the technology, but the thing is, you mustn't be a slave to it. You know this thing about Watson being so smart and everything and everybody being wowed by it? I don't think that I've heard anybody mention the idea of using the Turing test on Watson, which is the sort of classic test to find out whether a thing is a computer or not, if it can behave like a human. And the test, of course, is, I'm sure everybody's heard of the Turing test, but anyway, you can look it up on Wikipedia. But the thing is, I've never heard anybody talk about Watson using that. The other thing is, I've lost my train of thought here. I mean, I'm here in my car here, and I've got to sort of be careful with the traffic and
this
things.
This would be a perfect time for some life logging to go on, it sounds like. Well, let's start with your first question, Will. Clive Thompson, he was bringing up the idea of becoming slaves to technology, and you do hear the concerns that, you know, we'll be out walking around a downtown somewhere, and you'll start to see people who are so engrossed in their phones that they walk into light poles or into traffic.
Sure.
Heaven forfend. And you start to wonder sort of who's in control here, the phone or the person.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the phone thing, in one sense, I think is more of a social protocol than an enslavement thing, because what people are, the problem really with the phone thing is that people are not enslaved to the technology; they're enslaved to other people. What they're doing is they're communicating with other people. And we're such social animals, we find that so pleasant that when we're given it, we just keep on doing it and keep on doing it, even when we walk in with telephone poles. So we have to generate social protocols that say, look, you know, don't be a jerk. And we've done this before. We did it with mobile phones. When mobile phones came along, people used to answer them all the time. They answer them in church, they answer them at funerals, answer them while having sex. Finally, we realized, no, we can't do that. And we pulled back from that social behavior. But this point about over-reliance, I think, is really interesting, because I think it is true. It is true that if you over-rely on a technology too early, you can sort of deflate your human abilities. Here, classic example, children and calculators. If you give children calculators too young in their math learning, they will not learn the deep internal math they need to learn by being forced to do that by pencil and paper and in their head. But if they've amassed their basic knowledge in math and then you give them a calculator, it's actually beneficial because they can start using the calculator to play around with numbers and do these if-then experiments that are impossible by hand. So really, what we see over and over again with our use of technology is that we need to have basic human competencies in a bunch of different things. You know, at that point in time, it's absolutely powerful to have technologies that take over, that do automated processes for it, that help us out, that do things more efficiently. But we absolutely need, your speaker is absolutely right, we do need to have core human knowledge and ability built into us through the educational system, through our everyday practices, so that we can use these technologies intelligently.
Will, thanks so much for the call. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Let's take another call. This is Jewel calling from Laconia. Hi, Jewel. You're on the Exchange.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. What I'd like to talk about is how our advances in technology affect work. And I compare this to what we did with automating and industrializing agriculture and what we've done with technological advances in medicine. In both cases, we started out with this sense of this is wonderful, it just can't get better, it'll just improve and improve and improve. And then we realized how bad GMOs are. Today, we pay through the nose for what 100 years ago was standard, organic food. We also have found that antibiotics go too far. So what I'm saying is that we need to look at what technology does to the workplace. And I think that we can already see lots and lots of ways that it's had a very, very negative impact. And we need to preserve society by looking at work and seeing that people and work are more important than what we can possibly do with technology, and look at it from that perspective.
The big question. Thank you, Jewel, for the comment and for the question. And Clive, one of the many issues that you write about in regards to work and technology is the concern that many people have that they're going to be checking their phones throughout the course of the night, weekends, vacations, simply because they can be connected, that their employers are expecting them to be.
That's right. I think the caller has nailed something really well here, which is that technologies are not politically inert. They all carry political implications, and if we don't scrutinize and act on those political implications, they will take control. And I think they already have, right? You know, what you just talked about there, this whole problem of over-messaging. When you talk to people and say, okay, so why do you feel the need to check your email all the time on the weekends? They'll say, well, because my boss will kill me if I don't, right? And so what's happening is that the white-collar workers are now facing the same problem that 100 years ago, 150 years ago, the working class workers faced as they were, you know, in factories working 70, 80 hours a week. And it took collective political action on the part of unionization and state and governments to say, no, we actually have to have a limit on this. You cannot make infinite demands on these employers. They have to have a living wage, and they have to have a conscripted amount of time to work. You know, faith traditions and unions understood the need for the weekend as a revitalizing time. The white collars are now being put in the exact same position. And frankly, the only answer is really a social, political, and civic one. This is not something people can fight on an individual level. Now, we know from the very few experiments that have been done in these rare situations where a company actually has enough self-awareness to step back from this, that whenever a company says, okay, you know, no email on the evenings and weekends, you need to go out, you need to have a separate life, you need to be away from your screens, this is fabulous and beneficial for everyone involved. The employers are calmer, the company has a better time because people come back rejuvenated on Monday. So, but the truth is, look, you know, we know from politics that opposing forces need to be opposed. So, when you have companies that are pushing really, really, really hard, there needs to be a pushback, and that's only going to come collectively from the workers. This is exactly a political problem.
Jewel, thanks so much for that call. Again, the exchange number 1-800-892-6477. We have another listener on the line. Christian is calling from the White Mountains. Hi, Christian. You're on the exchange.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Go ahead.
I'm an educator, and it's really interesting for me to see how my students interact with technology. And one of the issues that I see is they can do a myriad of things on computers and on their smartphones and everything. And then when it comes to something like formatting a Word document, changing the font of their text or something like that, they seem to struggle.
And so so they're able to use technology in some fashions, but in others, they're still having trouble.
Yeah. It seems like social media, things mentioned before, like Snapchat, those sorts of things are like second nature to them. But then I get questions about, you know, how do I double space this paragraph or something like that. And I think it's interesting to see, being young myself, I'm 25 years old, it's interesting to see how it doesn't seem as though those kinds of skills are being taught and the good parts of technology aren't being utilized.
That's a great question, Christian, and one actually that, Clive, you write about in the book. I remember a piece where you're talking about some teachers who were able to show their students about the scientific method using World of Warcraft online gaming.
Yeah, absolutely. The first thing I'll talk about that. The first one I want to respond directly to your caller, because I think he's nailed something perfectly, which is that, and I argue this in my book, this whole myth of digital natives, that young kids, if they grow up with the technology, will effortlessly understand them, be very fluent in it, completely wrong, right? That we've been laboring under this illusion for a decade, and it has had disastrous problems because it's created the idea that the school system, that parents do not need to actually teach the kids the basics of how these tools work and how to use them intelligently, because we assume they're going to learn them on their own. And this is simply not true. And study after study shows that kids are, say, for example, are extremely naive at using Google. They'll just pick the top, you know, result. They won't even think about what's being presented or why it's being presented. They just trust the machine. This is disastrous, right? This is disastrous. But it's because no one has ever stopped and said, we need to teach this stuff. And so what I think the caller is saying, is realizing here, is that, you know, for the technology the kids are innately interested in because they help broker their socializing, they'll work hard to figure out how to use that stuff. They'll figure out Snapchat. No one needs to teach that. But when it comes to a formal tool that's used for formal communications, something like Word, something like Excel, something like these other things, that, you know, the education system and parents need to step in. There is no such thing as digital natives. You know, all complicated tools require training. I went to the University of Toronto before the internet. It was back in the mid 80s, and we had a fantastic research library, but almost no kids showed up for the orientation on how to use it, and professors would complain later on, yeah, they don't use any secondary sources, they don't use journals, they don't even know journals exist, you know. Unless you're trained to use, no matter what the cognitive augmentation is, whether that is an online technology or whether that's an offline one like a library, if you're not trained how to use it, you're not going to get the benefit out of it. Now, as you point out, teachers have realized that there are things they can work with that kids are already doing that they can tease fantastic lessons out of. They can observe that kids are playing games, and they're already engaging in the scientific method. They're doing these if-then experiments. They're making hypotheses, and they would go to the kids and say, you know, this is what the scientific method is, and they would use it as a way that you can use things kids are already doing to help educate them. But this takes an awful lot of attentiveness on the part of teachers. It's not easy to do. The best teachers are out there. They're doing it, but it takes a lot of work.
Christian, thanks so much for your question. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in The Exchange, Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. Author Clive Thompson, in his new book, explores the evolution and revolution underway as digital tools exponentially enhance our abilities and change the way we conduct our lives. Although there are some concerns about shrinking attention spans, distractibility, or other social changes, Thompson says progress has always had its naysayers, and he counts himself as an optimist. When we come back after a short break, we'll take a look at some of the lesser-known facets of technological change, even in TV shows like Breaking Bad. That's coming up after a short break. We'll also take more of your comments and questions. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Day in Ream show, Pope Francis sat in the global reach of his message of compassion. Then a review of the holiday season's best new movies, all coming up on the Day in Ream show.
The Day in Ream show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. New Hampshire weather, we have a freezing rain advisory in effect for most of the state till noon today. It remains in effect in Hillsborough and Rockingham County still for this afternoon. A winter weather advisory in effect in Coos County till 4 this afternoon. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and Dartmouth-Hitchcock primary care doctors and nurses who put you at the center of health. 13 locations statewide. Information at d-hdocs.org. And the League of New Hampshire Craftsman Retail Galleries in Concord, Hanover, Littleton, Meredith, Nashua, and North Conway. Information at nhcrafts.org. It is 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's a holiday favorite. We replay Laura's conversation with Gerald Charles Dickens about his one-man version of his ancestor Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. You hear that program tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock here on New Hampshire Public Radio. Today, Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. Could technology be having a positive effect on our brains and on our culture? You can join us with author Clive Thompson by calling 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Our guest is Clive Thompson, a science and technology writer. He contributes to Wired and New York Times Magazine and blogs at Collision Detection. His new book is called Smarter Than You Think: How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. We've talked a lot about how digital spaces have changed as a result of these new technologies and new abilities to interface both with computing power and with the crowd, the other people that we connect with online. But this isn't that; those are more obvious places, websites and digital spaces. You'd almost expect that. But you use an example in the book of how technology has made art and media more complex, and it's the show Breaking Bad. Can you explain a little bit about how that's worked?
Well, sure. One of the things that's really been interesting about TV is that for the longest time, it was a medium that that you could only just have wash over you. You know, you sat down on your chaise lounge, and basically the TV just went past you, and that's why it was sort of regarded as quintessentially sort of a stupid propagandistic medium.
The idiot like, box, it was called.
Yeah, the idiot box, exactly. But what started happening when you got things like the TiVo is that people began pausing and scrutinizing television. They began realizing, oh, I could stop this. I need to look at this over and over again. And the second thing that happened is people started talking to each other online. So the show would be over, and they would immediately storm onto the big discussion board at Television Without Pity or whatever discussion board, and they would talk and talk, and they would write tens of thousands of words and have these very erudite conversations. This began to create sort of a pressure for TV to actually get a lot smarter. And you would talk to TV creators, and they realized, well, when you have an audience that's networked and talking to each other, when they have the ability to pause and look closely at television, you can now make television that is enormously more complicated because people are paying much closer attention to it. And a networked audience, many heads are much smarter than one. So this is exactly what we've seen over the last 10 years. When you look at things like The Wire, when you look at things like Breaking Bad, when you look at things like Lost or Sherlock, you see these incredibly complicated narratives that almost can't be watched unless you have the ability to stop, go back over something, the same way that with a piece of text, when we're confused, we stop and go back over something. And people can also respond using video, which is really interesting. So Breaking Bad, fourth season, there was this big mystery. A child was being poisoned. No one could figure out why. People were arguing and arguing and arguing about it in these discussion boards, tens of thousands of words. And then in the middle of this, someone put up a video, JCham979, not sure who it was, never found out, put up a video on YouTube that did this, that did this composite, almost Talmudic scrutiny of the episode, like pulling out screen grabs on a frame by frame millisecond basis to point out the way in which this poison was transferred from one person to another, and fingering the main person, Walter White, as the guy that masterminded it. This is very audacious visual argument made about a visual medium. And I looked at that and I thought, well, this is really what's starting to happen. We're beginning to see visual literacy at the level of scrutinizing the shows and responding to them.
You write that, in a way, we're becoming more conversational thinkers. And in this case, it's called the second screen effect. The idea is that the audience is not merely content with watching a program. They want to watch the program as other people are watching the program and interact and participate at the same time they're watching the program.
Yeah, exactly. And when you think about it, TV, you know, always had that social element. People, you know, the idiot box idea was one person sitting there, but frankly, it was often several people sitting there. The whole idea behind appointment TV was that, you know, you got several people all sitting there, and they would talk a lot, and they would argue, and I saw this. I remember friends of mine that got addicted to Buffy back in the 1990s. They'd have parties, like 9 or 10 of them all sitting there, and they would have these, as soon as the show was over, they'd have this long, 2-hour-long argument about what happened. And so that has just started to happen online in a disparate way in text with people. It's like these, you know, amateur literary societies of the 19th century arguing about novels through letters.
Let's take another call from our listeners. Mike is calling from Gilmanton. Hi, Mike. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. Yeah, my question is around technology evolution. You know, I've been in the technology industry for about 30 years, and I don't want to date myself, but I've seen a lot of progress. But over the last, you know, 3-4 years with the event of, if you guys can hear me, with the event of like Siri and the iPhone 4S, right, the ability to start to talk and to communicate and then get collective questions, right, and get intelligence back in in a model that I've never, you know, you're not typing questions, you're not doing something into a search engine, but you're starting to get, you know, more more data back, and you're also more awareness. So my question is really around awareness. When is the technology or the interface on the other side going to get to that point that it's really following you, like you see in some of the science fiction movies?
And or I think of the computer in the original series, the original Star Trek series, where you could ask basically any question and the computer would know what you meant and immediately give you the answer you were looking for. Great question, Mike. What do you make of that, Clive?
Well, I think he's right. It's definitely on that trajectory. You can already see it there to a certain extent. When you do a Google search on your phone or even on your computer, they measure a bunch of metrics about who you probably are and where you are to help disambiguate a query, right? So if I do a search in my local neighborhood for this restaurant called Kiku, well, there's restaurants called Kiku all over the country, but they geolocate where I am and pull up the ones that are right nearby. So you're beginning to see this stuff in mobile phones, you see a bit more because they have sensors that track where you are, that track, you know, your movement. They're beginning to be able to track your mood based on, there's patents on, you know, holding your phone, galvanic skin response that can tell what your mood is. So yes, you're going to have a lot more of this interaction where they try and know what's going on and helping you out. I'm of two minds about this. I think that in some situations this can be fantastic, like in aspects of everyday life that are about simply finding a basic piece of information. You know, I'm looking for a parking lot. Is there one near me? Well, it knows I'm driving. It's finding one for me. That level of efficiency is terrific. I am less convinced it's a good idea when it comes to more complicated forms of thought. In fact, I think that when predictive technologies and AI try and get a little too fancy with our higher order thinking, they can go disastrously awry. In fact, artificial intelligence, this is the whole big data problem, has found that, you know, the low-hanging fruit is pretty good. You know, like help someone know what time of day it is. Okay, remind them of this. We can do that. But it comes to the higher order stuff, like, what's the next thing I should be thinking about? You know, what is? Show me something that will surprise me, that will bring serendipity into my life. This stuff, the holy grails, will get machines that can do this for us, but I'm less convinced that that's actually going to be possible. I think it's ignoring a resource that's already here and around us, which is other humans, right? Other people are fantastic conduits to serendipity, to knowledge, to collaboration. And one of the great things that we're seeing with modern technologies is it's allowing people to connect in different ways to other people. Clay Shirky talks, he has a great phrase about this. The writer, he says, we have persistently overestimated the value of access to information and persistently undervalued the value of access to each other. And so I think in some respects, we're going to see more and more of this predictive AI, but I don't want to see too much of it when it comes to my harder thinking. I want that to be still something actively I do along with smart people that I want to think with.
Mike, great question. Thank you so much for the call. And this actually ties into the third bias that you bring up about new tools and what they encourage, and that's more of and new kinds of communication and publishing. Now, we've always had access to each other, and if we had a question, we could always shout it out to colleagues or to shout it out to family members. One of the things that you write about is that now we have access or better access to what are known as weak ties. Not necessarily that we can find information from our friends and associates, but we can get information from their friends and associates.
That's right. That's right. Now, weak ties are really interesting because if you look at the history of the sociology of knowledge, whenever we need something new piece of information, a novel piece of information, when we go looking for it, we almost always find the best stuff through these weak ties, through people that we do not know very well. Strong ties, you know, four or five good friends, we know them really well, they know us really well. They're great for basic everyday stuff, emotional support, you know, we need those people. But if you want to find a job, or if you want to find a recommendation for, I don't know, you're trying to find a babysitter, or you're trying to find a recommendation for the best a digital camera to buy or something like that, that information tends to come from weak ties, someone you don't know very well, friend of a friend of a friend. Now, historically, it was really, really hard to get in contact with those people because we just didn't, unless you're one of these, you know, Malcolm Gladwell super connectors, people with enormous social skills that's always connecting with people. Most of us were not like that. I wasn't like that. We couldn't really connect to a lot of weak ties. But now, through things like social networks, through Twitter, through Facebook, we can broadcast a question, a query, and it can go out to people who will forward it to other people, and you can get these fantastic connections of weak ties. This happens all the time. Everyone I talk to will have some amazing story of something they were puzzling over, they were trying to find out, and by just doing that act of public thinking, by saying, okay, here's what I'm looking for, putting it out there, within hours, someone who knew someone who someone they didn't even know that existed was able to answer their question for them. So weak ties are a very, very big deal in the warp and woof of modern thinking.
And what's fascinating, too, is that as we can tap into these networks that we couldn't tap into before, you start to see that people recognize the value there. I was talking with some college career counselors recently, and they said that this used to be one of those sort of underground things that people use to find jobs. Now that's the skill that they teach people. They teach college students, think consciously about your network, think consciously about the people who are in your network and their networks, and start to figure out how you can get in touch with those people so that you can find jobs, that you can find internships, that you can find opportunities you might have missed before.
And here's a really fun thing, is that most people who've looked at this weak tie social power acknowledge one thing that's very valuable, which is that the best way, if you really want to have a lot of weak ties that are useful, one of the best ways to get them is to be useful yourself, right? Is to be someone who does a bit of social thinking on a daily basis. You know, is posting, oh, here's some interesting stuff I found, posting thoughtfully, answering questions, you know, sort of being a useful person in this new civic realm. The people that behave like that, they get a lot of, you know, they get more followers, they get a wider range of followers. People discover, oh, this person is sort of an expert in this interesting subject, let's go look at them. It really is like a virtuous cycle. The people who themselves are most useful to other people in the public realm get more use out of that public realm. When time comes to them to have a question answered or to get a referral, there are more people out there that are like following them and going, oh, yes, I want to help that person out. And I hear that over and over again also.
And another example of that might be in a situation that you wrote about in Tahrir Square during the Arab Spring in Egypt, where protesters started to organize and gather the supplies that protesters needed as they were in Tahrir Square. This was not a situation where people who necessarily knew each other were coming together and forming this. This was people all recognizing the same need and sort of coming together around a central Twitter account called @TahrirSupplies. And the community organized itself and they started moving huge amounts of supplies all organically.
Yeah, absolutely. This was a young student, a former Egyptian guy. He was in Dubai. He just finished his pharmacy degree, and he was watching as everything exploded in Tahrir Square in the first blush of the Arab Spring, and he realized they needed all these pharmaceutical supplies, they needed all this medicine and help, and he could sort of, because he was on Twitter and following the Twitter accounts of hundreds and hundreds of his friends, he could see, he had this sort of 50,000 foot in the air view of what was going on, and he realized, wow, I can actually take advantage of this of my network map view of what's going on to try and identify, okay, we need these four tents set up in these four places, and we're going to need these supplies. And it was very simple. He set up a Google Doc. He set up a spreadsheet, and he listed all the things people were looking for, and he encouraged people to go and look at that list and buy the things they needed, tick it off, and bring it there. And so it was just like these very simple tools for collaboration unlocked an enormous amount of goodwill and collective behavior on the part of people. It saved a lot of lives.
And yet a number of times there are situations where crowdsourced ideas and projects don't come off as they were intended. They don't come off as well as they did in Tahrir Square. And that's one of the concerns that you hear when people talk about the power of the crowd, is that it can sometimes fall down. And there are other concerns, too. I mean, we've talked about people coming together online around a show that they like or a project that they can work on together. But at the same time, you also see very concerning incidents of bullying, oftentimes threats against women who are speaking out in the tech industry and things like that. How do we ameliorate those kinds of problems which crop up quite frequently, while at the same time being able to find constructive ways to use these new platforms?
Yeah, this is really the big and I think most important question around public thinking. So, all right, so public thinking, very valuable. The average person can now talk in public, can share ideas, can tap ideas. But you know, the inevitable result of uncorking that amount of public expression is you are also going to uncork the minority of very vocal, abusive, or threatening voices, right? People who actually enjoy going out and being abusive, often to subaltern communities, to women, to minorities. And so how do you deal with that? Well, one of the problems we have right now is that a lot of the forums that have been set up where this stuff engages in are not very well moderated or organized at all. Newspapers are a classic example of this. Newspapers are pretty lazy about this. They put up a comment field at the bottom of their stories, and they just say, well, we'll let people talk. Maybe we'll ban the occasional person. But what we know from people who have done studies of social dynamics and online is that this is a social environment. It requires social hosting, right? So I've been running a blog for 10 years, and I've learned what everyone else has learned, which is that it is important for someone who runs the show to be there in the discussion forums all the time, talking, showing people that they're present, rewarding the good actors, saying, the people who are behaving well, saying, hey, this is great, keep this going, and punishing the bad ones and setting the tone. And if you set that tone for a long time, and it takes an enormous amount of social work, it tends to drive all the bad actors away because they go to places that are anarchic, where no one is in control. And so the problem we're faced right now is that there are too many places where no one is taking any responsibility. This is a real corporate failing in a lot of places, because most of the places where this abuse happens are on, again, newspapers or on corporate websites where they are setting it up. They're greedy. They want the eyeballs. They want people looking at this stuff. But they are lazy. They do not want to do the social work necessary to impose civil discipline. And so there is no good civil behavior online without there being corresponding social work. I often tell newspapers, look, if you're not going to put the social work into this, just shut your comments down. We don't need them. We don't need to see the weird abuse that comes out of you catalyzing the worst urges of the minority of people in your community who are terrible.
And with that, we're going to have
social work is always necessary.
We're going to have to turn it over to our community because we're out of time for the hour. Clive, we have come a long way from John Henry taking on the steam drill. Thanks so much for talking with me today.
I had a great time.
It's Clive Thompson, a science and technology writer. His new book is called Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. You can learn more about the book by checking out the Exchange page at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Brady Carlson, in for Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. The story of the Cratchits, Scrooge, and the ghosts who haunt him remains timeless, more than 150 years after it was first written. Gerald Charles Dickens, the author's great-great-grandson, joins us to talk about his namesake and perform some memorable scenes from A Christmas Carol. Join us for this special rebroadcast of The Exchange tomorrow morning at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
Public Radio, 959. Good morning. The Diane Rehm Show next at 10. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Lalise in downtown Concord, featuring resale ladies' apparel, accessories, and outerwear from Chanel and Louis Vuitton to Coach in contemporary and vintage styling. Lalise on Facebook. And Ford & Associates PA, providing representation for businesses, trustees, and institutional creditors in bankruptcy and troubled debt matters. Ford & Associates PA.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3. WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
and WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. On his 77th birthday last week, the leader of the nation's 1.2 billion Roman Catholics, Pope Francis, invited three men who live on the streets of Rome to join him for breakfast. The move is consistent with the downturn.